The Orange FM.
Welcome, Voltron fans. This is Mark Morrell, your host for the Let's Voltron podcast, and I'm here with Mike French. Mike, how you doing?
I am not bad at all. How are you doing, Mark?
Boy, I got to tell you, this is one of the most exciting podcasts we've done, and it's all because we're going back 30 years to the beginning, basically.
Yeah, I'm super excited about this interview. This is a childhood dream come true, and I can't wait.
All right. I wanted to ask you a quick question. Is there anything going on at World Events right now?
I would say the biggest thing is the release of Robotech Voltron number 2 from Dynamite Comics, which you can download right now on Comixology. It's the continuation of the ultimate mecha mashup, as I like to call it. It's Voltron and Robotech together in the same universe. I've had the pleasure of reading issue number 2, and you know, Tommy Yoon is really doing just a bang-up job on it. He's left nothing, no small detail has been left to chance. If you're a fan of Urak, the original second-in-command to Zarkon, you're going to see some cool, interesting little details that Tommy throws in, and that just sort of permeates the whole series there. He really just has a great handle on the mythology, so I can't wait to hear what fans think of the continuation of the story.
And who isn't a fan of Urak?
Oh, I know, right?
Yeah.
I'm more of a Cossack guy myself, but hey, I'll throw that out there.
Hey, Jeremy.
Hey, Jeremy's back.
Yes,
absolutely. When you have Mark Handler on the show, then it's the 30th anniversary of Voltron. Just like all the other Let's Voltron listeners, I can't miss this. And so I snuck in the VIP room here. I'm chilling out in the green room, eating all the hors d'oeuvres and having myself a Voltron salad, whatever that is. It's made up of red, blue, and black things. And I'm just going to sit back and hear some stories of one of what I consider the fathers of Voltron, of the many godfathers and stewards of this incredible brand. And I've got my own questions, but I just want to hear from Mark Handler.
Yes, we're talking about a member of the original production team of the original Voltron series back from 1984. All right, this man is an amazing writer. All right, he's done an amazing body of work. And just in the Voltron realm, he's done, you know, almost a 30 full years here. He's been working on the original series. He was the one that replaced Jameson Brewer as the head writer. He came on after that. He did the Fleet of Doom special. He wrote that. And then he also worked on Voltron the Third Dimension as the head writer. So I would like to introduce to everyone Mark Handler.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks very much for the big intro. I don't know about all the father of 30 years past. I want you to know I was a child prodigy and was only 8 years old when I was writing all of that. So I'm still at the beginning of my career here.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's a true fact.
And what were we doing at 8 years old? Jeez, oh, Pete. Yeah. Mark was pounding on the typewriter, working with Peter Keefe and John Teichman.
That's
Watching, we were eating all of it up.
Hey, Mark, why don't we start at the very beginning and you tell us exactly how you got involved with Voltron, Defender of the Universe?
Well, it was through Heidi Lester. Heidi worked with Steve Sterling at the very beginning of the show, and they had read I wrote a kid's book, which was a fantasy book, and Heidi had read it. I had been like just traveling around Europe at that time, wrote that book while I was traveling. So it was a really kind of free and easy fantasy piece. And Heidi read it and introduced me to Peter Keefe. And I started working on it then. And I really was not very familiar with anime at that time. So I was introduced to it. And it was like, wow, this is fun. This is great. And I jumped right into it. And I've been involved in anime ever since.
So what were some of your original influences in anime, even before you got involved with Voltron?
Oh, well, you know, I mean, I have the sort of obvious answer to that. I mean, Miyazaki just blew me away. When I first saw Laputa, Tenko no Shiro, Laputa, I actually looked them up, tracked them down in L.A. I mean, they were unknown at the time. And those shows were being, like, passed around from animator to animator. They had not played in the U.S., and people were just passing them around and going, take a look at this stuff they're doing in Japan. And when I saw it, I actually tracked down, they had a little office somewhere in LA, and practically begged them to hire me to localize Miyazaki's stuff. But I didn't make any progress with that. But, I just on that note, I watched Cento Chihiro again, Spirited Away recently, and it just blew me out of my seat. Material is so strong and it's so real. You know, it's not formula stuff. It's really coming out of this guy's imagination and his heart. And so he's really been a guiding light. And he worked for Toei. He started off working for Toei Animation, which is the same company that created Voltron.
Right. So what was the first episode that you worked on with Voltron?
Lotor Traps Pitch. That was the title. Lotor Traps Pitch. That was it. So yeah, that was my first intro to it, and it's about a little kid named Tommy who kills a rabbit to help his poor mother. And that's not exactly what you would normally do in an American show. It's like, hey mom, I killed a little bunny for you. So it was kind of a good intro to anime.
What was your first impression of the way that they were making these episodes back then?
You mean the way that the Japanese were making them?
The way that Franklin and Peter and everybody on the team were making these episodes from those original.
Right. It was all new. And that was the thing about it. Like last year, 2013, I worked on several different international projects in China, in Korea. And I worked on Power Rangers, on the new version of the Power Rangers. And the thing about all of these projects is you go on them and everybody knows how to do this. There are methods. There are ways that you take a show from Korea and localize it to the U.S. or from China or whatever, or Japan. But at that time, we didn't have those methods. We didn't know how to do it. We just had to figure it out as we went. Franklin came up with a lot of the methods, and we all sort of put our heads together and figured out the best way to do it. So we were inventing it all as we went. And that made it really fun and kind of crazy. I don't know if you're aware of this, but we recorded with a stopwatch. I mean, nobody does that now. It's a very strange way to record. We timed out every speech down to the hundredths of a second.
Wow.
So if you looked at my scripts, and I pulled some of them up here for the interview. If you look at my original scripts, you would see these little mathematics all over them, little numbers, because I would have to, and all the writers would have to do this, we would have to calculate out. You'd find the time code, mark the beginning of where the mouth flap begins, find the end of it, and then calculate out exactly how many seconds, tenths of a second, and hundreds of a second that was, and that would be on the script along with a lot of other notation. And then when they recorded it in the booth, they would have that stopwatch going and actually try to match it to the voice. And that's the way they did it.
Wow.
It was crazy and it was fun.
The schedule that you guys were on at the time, about how many episodes were you churning out a week?
Oh, gosh. I actually don't remember. All I remember is from my point of view, I was just writing one after the other. It never stopped to the point where I used to mention this. I used to actually sleep on the floor of the offices at times because it just wasn't worth it to go home. So I had this thing going where I would have at the back of my desk drawer, I would have toothpaste and soap. And in the morning, I'd make sure that I got up before anybody came into the office, and I'd run into the bathroom and kind of clean up and pretend I just got there early. So I thought if they knew that I'd slept on the floor, they'd think I was kind of losing my my touch with reality, which I probably was.
You mean because nobody else was doing that?
Yeah, I'm the only one who was sleeping on the floor of the offices. Yeah, that's right.
It can now be revealed on the Let's Voltron podcast. That's what we like, that uncensored information.
Yeah, maybe more than you wanted to know, right? But on those recording sessions, you know, I remember going into Franklin's recording sessions, and it would be funny because I had written to the timing, but they had to, you know, they had to struggle with that all the time. So he'd be like, Franklin Kofod, who was the producer and who ran the recording session, he'd like to have his arms folded and say, okay, Handler, let's see you say this speech in 3.46 seconds, you know, and the actor would be there going, yeah, let's see you do it. So I would have to like make my own lines work, which was, you know, their way of giving me a hard time, sort of. But I was up to the challenge. I always like to do that. It's like, yeah, hell yes, I wrote it. I can say it in the right amount of time.
Now, was there anything about the storylines at the time that you were looking forward to either adapting, changing, or adding on to?
Well, you know, I'll tell you what I loved about them. I mean, you know, a story like There Will Be a Royal Wedding. That's the one where Romel finds Sven underneath the planet Doom. I mean, that's right out of Shakespeare. He's like, Sven is like, it's like the story of Edmund and Edward in Lear. He's gone crazy, you know, living like a wild man and all of this. So there were these great, you know, classic elements in these stories, and I loved that. But I think what really struck me and what I really loved about it especially was the mix of motifs. I remember, you know, my background, I studied, among other things, I studied writing for film and television, and I also studied directing for the stage. And they would always say, you know, well, you have to have a style. You have to know what style your show is, and then you have to fit everything into that style. And I always felt like, why? Why do you have to have one style? Why can't you mix styles? What is, you know, where is that written in heaven that you have to have one style and follow it? So when I saw Voltron, I was like, yes, I love this because it mixes styles. And I don't know if you've ever sort of thought about it or gone through it, but you look at that show, and this is what struck me right away. You've got space motifs. You've got these guys dressed in uniforms like, you know, Buck Rogers, futuristic outer space guys in helmets and all of that. But their enemies are dressed like medieval Vikings, 700 AD. And then you've got Koran, who is dressed like pre-Victorian England. That's about the 1700s. That's like 1,000 years later, motif-wise, than Lotor and Zarkon and all of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you've got Alfor, who shows up exactly like the ghost of Hamlet, wearing a Tudor England costume. That's a completely different era. And then you've got Bandor, who shows up wearing a toga, you know, mm-hmm. from ancient Rome. I mean, and then when the Voltron Force works out, they're wearing Japanese gis, you know, when they practice martial arts. And all of Voltron's, you know, blazing swordplay is straight out of samurai, you know, the old samurai movies. So you put all these things together that normally would not go together, and they just mix them, you know, wildly, impulsively, and come up with this wonderful mix of motifs. And, you know, you just don't see that in American shows and Western shows. And I thought that's what made it really a lot of fun, this sort of, you know, wild, no holds barred creativity, just going wherever they wanted to go. I love that about it.
Yeah. You were talking about the Shakespeare motif. There was a point in the third dimension. And I don't know if a lot of people caught on to this when Hagar was talking about her, you know, relationship with Alfor.
Uh-huh, right.
And at the time, it seemed like a Romeo and Juliet type of a situation.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And the families of each of them told him they couldn't see each other anymore.
Right, right.
And, you know, he stayed away, and she thought he was going to come after her, and he never did. And that's why she became as evil as she did.
Right, exactly.
I just thought it was a really, really nice way of bringing the Shakespeare Romeo and Juliet into it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for remembering that. I love that part of that show, that we were able to fill in the backstory about Hagar and tell who she was and why. I always had the feeling of kind of you sympathize with her throughout the whole series because, you know, Zarkon was so crappy to her. And you thought somehow you felt sympathy for her. So to try to get into her and find out, well, who is she? What's her backstory? How did she become this old witch? I love the opportunity to show that and actually show the other side of her where she ends up helping Allura in that story. And we see we see who she used to be and we see the good side of her. That was really a privilege to be able to write that, you know, fill in that part of the Voltron backstory.
And while we're on that, can we talk about the little backstory for Hagar in Fleet of Doom? Because that was slightly different. And you saw a Hagar that was sort of like a blonde coming out of her.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, where we see her in her backstory. I think we connected those things up. Exactly, where she helps Allura in that story.
Yeah, I just wanted to know, and this is Jeremy, Mark.
Hi, Jeremy.
Hello again. What was that like as far as season two? What were some of the challenges then when, you know, you guys were able to produce your own animation, fill in your own backstory? Was it kind of a pivot in what you guys were doing, in that in one sense you were season one translating and sort of adapting and while still creating your own mythology there? What was that like to be able to open range on the stories and characters?
Well, that was really fun, especially with that, you know, that one show where we could, what I saw that as was an opportunity to say, you know, we took, as you well know, we took two shows that were not connected, two giant robot shows that were not connected, and we were running them side by side. So this was an opportunity to connect them. And so the idea of seeing both Voltrons, you know, fighting together, joining forces and connecting the two Voltron forces, that was a great opportunity. And that was our main thought. And then to fill in, you know, to fill in some of the backstory and who they are and why they're there, that was really fun. So we saw that as an opportunity. And of course, since we had been just before that, we had been following the stories that already existed, it was fun for us to be able to add our ideas to it.
When you approach Toy to do that animation, do you remember? Do you remember any of their reactions? You know, because not only was Fleet of Doom mostly original animation, but also the last few episodes of Lion Voltron were the same way. I mean, did they look at you and say, "I guess we can put Die Rugger and Go Lion together. Sure, why not?" Like, you know.
Well, I wrote the story of Fleet of Doom, so we brought it to them, and it was basically, this is what we're, you know, asking you to animate. I was not in on the conversation. That would have been Peter Keefe, and perhaps Ted Koppler might have been in on that conversation, but I never heard any negatives, so I think that they were fine with it.
I just always thought it would have been weird for them to have heard something like that and go, "Oh yeah, Sven is dead. I guess we can animate him back to life." You know, because I didn't know how closely they followed it.
Well, that's a good point. When we did "Who's Flying Blue Lion," when we brought Sven back, and that's an episode that I did. We did that ourselves. I don't know if you're aware of that. We created that out of footage that already existed. So I don't think that the toy guys were really in on that. We just put that together.
Was there any thought when you were doing Fleet of Doom or the third dimension of bringing Sven into the mix?
You know, we had already brought him back. And, you know, after that, after the show that I mentioned, there will be a royal wedding. And at the end of it, we leave him with Romel in her world. So I think we were happy to just have him there. He was sort of where he was supposed to be. So I don't think we sort of contemplated going beyond that.
Okay.
And, you know, we like the princess being in Blue Lion. I don't know if you recall this, but, you know, at the time we got a lot of letters from kids going, "Hey, you know, Sven should be piloting Blue Lion. The princess should be in the throne room. She should be in her pink dress," kind of thing. There were a lot of boys who didn't like the idea of having a girl flying the flying line. But of course, I like the idea. So we want the princess there.
And I got to tell you, Mark, those same people writing those letters, they're on our Voltron Facebook still, and they're still not over it. I just throw that out there.
Gotta love that.
At what point, Mark Handler. Did you know that that the Voltron Lion Force was going to have original episodes? You know, at what point did you see? Did they say, okay, we're gonna not follow through with Albegas. We're gonna finish up Vehicle Force. And how did that conversation go? I mean, because I've always been curious about that.
Yeah, sure. You know, it certainly caught us by surprise. I certainly didn't start working on the show and go, oh my God, this is going to be a hit show right away. We didn't, you know, I don't think anybody suspected that. We just wanted to make it the best show that we could be. So it caught us by surprise in the middle of the first season. I certainly always, I mean, I liked the vehicle team and there were good things about it, you know, we could talk about, but still, it definitely seemed like the Lion team was the, you know, was the more exciting and more colorful show. So it did not surprise me at all that that was the show that was the most popular. But sometime in the middle of, you know, of the first season of airing, we were just going, wow, you know, we were just getting the great feedback and the great ratings and went, well, let's, you know, let's go with this. I had actually already started working on Arbegas and had written, you know, I had localized some of it and I had gone over it and studied it and all of that. So it was kind of like a loss to me when we dropped it, and I was interested in it, but I was still much happier to be just going with the robot Lions. I was very happy with that.
Wow, that's new information to me. I didn't know that you had started localizing
Arbegas. I watched it and I'd started working on scripts and the whole thing. I had done it on my own. They hadn't assigned me. I was kind of a little too gung-ho at the time. Peter hadn't asked me to do it, but I had just watched it and started working on it.
Sounds like you need to hunt down a floppy drive where that's on, and we can Kickstarter an Arbegas. That's always been myself and a lot of the fans kind of dreamed of, you know, just seeing an episode of that. So there's various
Let's
projects.
Let's do it. I would love to do it. I liked it at the time. I was loving the show, and I was looking forward to working on it.
So. Well, we all remember the toy from the playground and just that simple screenshot on the side of the matchbox, and it just...
Right.
You know, I'm sure with like Mike French as well, just the imagination went wild. Like, what is this third Voltron series that we're not seeing?
I loved the intro of that show. I'm curious to find out, Mark, what kind of themes did you discover in that show that were unique from the other two series?
I would have to go back and watch it again to refresh my memory. I don't remember what the themes were. I'm sorry. I know that's a boring answer, but too far back.
I just want to know the characters' names, you know, if you had the air team leader and Keith, and that's a future thing. Wow, we're going to have to dig more into that.
Out. I mean, it's so far, you know, I don't have that on a hard drive somewhere because it was before I was working on a computer. So that lets you know what the time frame is. Yeah.
So I just wanted to get a sense of when those final 20 episodes that you had done that were original episodes, after those were over, how did the whole team feel knowing that they weren't going to be making any more Voltron?
Oh, we were good. We didn't have, there was no sadness or remorse or any of that because we moved right on to Saber Rider. And Saber Rider for me was also a really fun, exciting project. It never had the big, you know, super hit response that Voltron had, but it was a really fun show. Was very fun to work on. And then I went to Japan on that show. So I was moving right on to the next project. And I think so was Franklin and the whole team. So we were always moving forward.
Okay. So was Fleet of Doom written in response to, you know, fans' questions and things like that about getting, you know, Vehicle Voltron and Lion Voltron together? Was that just to satisfy those needs?
No. Although Who's Flying Blue Lion was. We were thinking of on that episode, we were thinking of the fans. People wanted to see Sven come back, and so we really wrote that directly in response to the fans, giving them what they wanted, and we wanted it too. We thought it was a great idea, so that was the case. But Fleet of Doom, no, that was really, you know, as soon as we said, well, what are we going to do with that episode? You know, immediately we thought, well, let's bring the two teams together and let's see both Voltrons, you know, fighting side by side.
And was it considered it was going to be a one-hour special?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if you know this, but we played it in theaters. We had a limited run in theaters at the time as well. That was fun.
That's something I didn't know.
That explains the 35-millimeter print
we have
somewhere.
Yeah.
So I always wondered about that.
Yeah, that was got to sit in theaters in L.A. and you know, watch it with kids watching it and seeing their reactions and all that. So that's always really fun. You know,
that must have been exciting.
It really was. The thing is, when you're working on a show like this, you always have the fans in your mind. You always have to remember, and you do remember, this is a communication between the guys creating it and the fans on the other side who are receiving it. There's all kinds of other stuff in between, business stuff and marketing stuff and technical stuff, but it really is a communication between the guys creating it and the guys on the other side, the fans who are receiving it. So you always keep that in mind. But on the other hand, you're isolated from them. We don't interact with the fans very often. I wish we did much more, but we don't. So they're kind of imaginary to us, and we're kind of imaginary to them. So it's very cool to actually be in the same room, whether it's at a convention or whether it's at a screening like this, where you're actually seeing the fans watching the show and responding to it. It's really a treat.
Well, one of the things that we do on this podcast is we don't forget about the fans at all. The fans are one of our primary focus on this podcast.
Right on.
So everything we do, we want to infuse the fans into it. And that includes some questions that we're going to be asking you later on.
Great.
But Mark, I'd like to hear more, and I'm sure Mark and Mike would as well, about, you know, Saber Rider. Is that something that we just slowly are uncovering and talking to guys like Brian Lacey and just seeing pictures of a proposed toy line from Bandai that never came out in North America? I'd love to hear all your memories of that show, because the animation that, you know, Studio Pierrot is doing, and there's been a definite Saber Rider resurgence going on in places like Germany with Anime House. So I'd love to hear more Saber Rider.
I loved working on that show. It was totally fun. It has an American cowboy who's just a hoot to write. He was totally fun. And then Saber Rider, who's this very, you know, formal Brit. And I think it's very interesting that the Germans love him, because he has that sort of formal back in time kind of gentlemanly quality to him and all. And he rides a horse through space, which is, again, it's the same kind of thing I was talking about. It's so fanciful. It's the kind of thing that I'm afraid a lot of American producers would go, well, I don't know, is that logical? You know, and the Japanese guys, they don't care about that. It's fun. It's colorful. It's exciting. They do it. And that's, they break, you know, what would be rules here. And that's what makes their stuff so much fun. Yeah, and the girl, April. So it was a team of three rather than a team of five, but it was still a Super Sentai show where they all end up in this robot. But the robot is a great big cowboy, and he's so cool when all the blasters come out. I had a great time working on that. I went to Japan, like I mentioned, and actually met with the production company over there. And really, it's at that point that I really started getting immersed in Japanese culture and all of that. Can I take this opportunity, now that I'm thinking about that, I want to take an opportunity to say a few things about that, about the Japanese side of this.
Yeah, go ahead.
Really, because, you know, it's I like doing an interview like this, and it's kind of flattering and all, but actually, you know, the real credit should go to the Japanese guys who originally created this, and I think we all know that. And that would start with all the way back with Osamu Tezuka, who created Astro Boy back in 1952 as a peaceful character, you know, after the war and all. Had he not done that, there would be no Voltron or anything else. He's the guy who broke ground and created, you know, the whole movement of Japanese anime, and especially robot anime. So credit goes to him.
Absolutely.
Tezuka, who we all know and love. And then Shotaro Ishinomori. He is the guy who created the first Super Sentai series circa 1975. It was called Himitsu Sentai Gorenger. So he created this genre, this type of show where you have a Sentai group, which is a fighting force, a squadron of fighters, and then they come together into a giant robot. So this was really his idea, and he should be, you know, he should be remembered and credited with this. It was his concept, came out of his, you know, imagination. And I don't know if you know this about him, but he is in the Guinness Book of World Records for having the most comics published by one author, totaling, ready for this, 128,000 pages.
Wow.
One guy, Ishinomori. So this guy again, deserves a lot of the credit. And he was discovered by Tezuka when he was like a kid, just starting out. Tezuka discovered him, brought him to his studios, and kind of trained him and brought him in. So you have this direct line from Tezuka to Ishinomori, and then on to the guys who created Voltron. And do you know, you guys, I know you guys are the experts and the fans also. Do you know who created Voltron?
I've got the name. Yeah.
As far as the Japanese name, gosh, I know it at one time. I don't think I know it now.
Saburo Yatsude, also known as Saburo Hatte. I'm not an expert at this, but in Japan, sometimes you have alternate names because you have a kanji that can be pronounced different ways. So I think that's the case here. So it has two different names. So who is Saburo Yatsude? Do you know? I get to play like guessing
quiz. Guys. No, this is great.
This is great.
Tommy Yoon was showing me something. He went on to do a motorcycle show where a guy looks like Keith and the fists are flying out of the robot. I'm trying to remember the exact. We had always heard Nakamura, the name Nakamura.
Well, that might be another guy who was involved at the beginning. But the actual credit for the creation of Voltron is Saburo Yatsude, a.k.a. Saburo Hatte. He doesn't exist. In other words, of the Japanese shows, that's who it says created him. But in fact, no such person exists. He is a pen name for the producers at Toei. So in other words, the producers at Toei sat down and said, what's our next show? They figured it out. They came up with the concept of Voltron, and then they created this imaginary name as the creator.
Wow.
It's like Daft Punk of Amp.
Right.
No, that's what we had found out as well, that it was, an amalgam of a whole team. That's often the case.
Yeah, it's a bunch of guys, and the same guy, Saburo Hatte, also created the Power Rangers, also at Toei.
So, all right, let's follow up on that then, because there were several people asking, did Power Rangers steal their idea from Voltron? So now you can say the same guy that created Power Rangers also created Voltron?
Yes, exactly. They can't steal the idea from themselves. This is the same group of guys. And again, Miyazaki was working at Toei at that time. So they had a group of really creative people there. And they came up with, it was part of a tradition, again, of these Super Sentai shows. And both of these shows are part of that tradition.
All right. So one of our fans out there on Twitter, Simon Wellard, had asked that question about Power Rangers. So there you go.
We can finally end the debate, folks. They're cousins. Yeah. Okay. There's no stealing.
I worked on both shows. I love both shows. Voltron is definitely my first love, but it was great working on both of them.
Now the fan debate will simply be what's better, that story animated or that story live action? That will be the debate now.
Well, right. I think we all know from the Let's Voltron podcast that Voltron is better. But that's, we were trying to do a comic book mashup. We had talked about Dynamite. I mean, the Robotech Voltron mashup was one of them. But we pursued a Power Rangers Voltron team up might even still be. Maybe Mark can write it. That would be amazing.
That'd be fun.
Hey, Mark, one of the other big things that were coming out of everybody out there was everybody knows that there's a live-action movie in the works.
Right.
So the question was if you could take all the best parts of Voltron and start a live-action movie, where would you begin?
Okay, I'd love to answer that question. It'll be fun. Before I do, can I hit on one other thing? Well, I mentioned these imaginary guys who created the show, Saburo Hatte, but also there were screenwriters who we know who did write these episodes. So the episodes, all I was doing was, and our team was doing, was taking their shows and, localizing them. Susumu Takaku, Masaaki Sakurai, Akira Nakahara, and Hiroshi Toda. I think Nakahara is the guy that you were referring to. So this was the writing staff who really deserve credit for these things. Be really fun if we could, if we can track any of them down and talk to them sometimes. I would be as interested in doing that as you guys would be.
That'd be awesome. Yeah, cool. Somewhere we had, and Mark, you probably used it, was it just looked like a direct translation of probably the original outline of the series and just kind of the setting and the place. And it was all kind of written in a very, you could see a Disney influence almost in there, just with the princess. But somewhere we recently discovered that document.
I would like to see it, actually. I probably have not seen it for 30 years, so it would be really fun to look back over it. And as to your other question about the Voltron movie, I actually, you know, it's gone through a few different companies, I think, at this point that have considered it. And I actually did a pitch for one of them at the beginning. So I have been involved in the process a bit. And I changed my mind about it as time goes on. You know, you could do an origin story. I think, Jeremy, I think that's your preference. And of course, we all love the original Voltron story going into the bombed out castle and all of that. My take on what I think I'd like to see, I think that would be fun, would be to pick up the Voltron force now, today, in our world, on planet Earth. This is what plays out in my mind. They won. They did it. They defended the universe. They defeated the Drool Empire. So Lotor had to come to the table, put down his weapons, and join the Galaxy Alliance and become one of the good planets. Very much like Germany after World War II. They were our enemies, but now they're our friends. We're all in the United Nations together. Angela Merkel is a friend, and we see her shaking hands with the president and all that. So now we're in a peaceful period. And it's like those old samurai movies where the samurai don't have much to do now that we're at peace, right? And characters who used to be heroes, now they're just kind of, you know, they're just another ex-space guy. So Eris is peaceful, Planet Doom is peaceful, all of these planets are peaceful, and one of the peaceful planets in the Galaxy Alliance is Planet Earth, right? It's our world today. And the Voltron Force end up getting stationed here. And they're just like normal space explorers, worlds at peace, pressure's off, they have normal daily duties, nothing stressful. And their time off, we see them take off their uniforms and hang out in L.A. or Des Moines, Iowa, or whatever. They're just like regular Americans. And they're nobody important. They're just, you know, military guys, you know, with a day off. And at the same time, you know, I mean, I fantasize about, okay, what would the world be? What is the galaxy like? Well, Lotor, even though he was a bad guy and we feel like he should be in jail or something, he's now an important intergalactic leader, right? So he's in the news and he's an important guy. And our guys, Keith and company, they're just not important guys anymore. Oh, yeah, didn't you used to be a hero? Keith still fails to propose to Allura. She's exasperated with him and just, you know, realizes he's never going to come around. And she is a princess, so she's not going to hang around with them. She's got to go back to Planet Eris and be, you know, run her planet. And so she is going, what's going to happen naturally? She's going to find herself at the same intergalactic events as Lotor, right? Charity events to help poor, needy planets. There's Allura trying to help them, and here's Lotor helping them even more.
And is he still fascinated with Allura?
Of course, that's the point. He is now in his reformed version. He's a good guy helping poor planets and, you know, high profile, this helpful guy. And he's all, when he's with Allura, he's all charm and sincerity. And hey, she can't hold on to the past, right? So you can see, you know, you can see where this is going. He's of course trying to draw her in. And Keith is jealous, but he, you know, Keith, he's not going to say anything. And so you start to get this relationship between Lotor and Allura, which has always been, you know, a fun possibility. You see the two of them together doing good works, Lotor and Allura. She kind of has to be with him and starts to get drawn in. And you've got the intergalactic paparazzi following them around, printing articles saying they're a couple now. You start, well, are they? Are Lotor and Allura a couple? So I think that's a really fun setup. And this is all going on Earth with our team on Earth. And of course, obviously, none of this is going to be as it seems. There's a lot more going on. Is Lotor fooling Allura? Is Allura playing a double game and fooling Lotor? And all of that. And then finally, when the story breaks open, which it'll do, of course, and the Voltron Force have to fight, they're stuck on Earth. They can't get to the robot lions. So they have to fight like regular humans right here. And they have to use their own resource, kind of a Tony Stark kind of thing where he doesn't have his robot suit. How is he going to fight? You know, he has to use his resources to do it.
You mean like post Iron Man 3?
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. He's okay. If he had to do that all over again. If they don't have the robot lions, how are they going to recreate that, or how are they going to make that happen? I think that could be really fun. And then when the battle finally breaks open, we're going to see robot lions fighting robeasts over Earth cities, over New York, over Tokyo, over the Shanghai skyline, Pudong or wherever it is. I think that would be really a hell of a lot of fun. So that's the direction I'd like to go.
I think that sounds amazing, and you heard it here first, podcast listeners. Crazy. Only listeners to our podcast get to hear Mark Handler just pitching it all out there. Just you're in the room, buddy. You're in the room with Mark Handler. That's amazing. And what's funny, what you're saying there, I'm gravitating in my head towards like a Voltron OVA, and what a great animated special that would be. And some of the themes you're hitting on there, we actually had similarly in development, where it was, what if we caught up with the Voltron Force in real time? I think at the time it was like 20 years later, and exactly like what you're saying, that sort of thing. So I'm starting the campaign, Mark Handler writing a Voltron OVA. Let's do this from the original writer of Voltron. Bring it back.
Yay.
I'm one of those thousands of heads that just exploded with all that all that storyline you just brought to us.
I'm nodding grimly with the sense of determination and common sense. Like, yes, that all makes sense. I'm behind you.
Yeah, I mean, it all grows out of who these characters already are and what has already happened in the past. So it all goes naturally into the future. And then, of course, we have to end up going back to Eris and back to Planet Doom. The whole thing should not take place on Earth. It should also go back to these locations that we love. But I'd love it if it started here.
And just for the fans' sake, what animation studio, you can give a couple, would you think would just do an incredible job? I have my own picks, but who could do something like that if we were to do an animated special?
Well, my first thought is Wizard, which is Josh Prickrell's studio. Josh is the guy who worked on Voltron 3D originally, and he worked on Voltron Force, and he now has his own studio in Hong Kong. And, you know, nobody knows the show better than he from an animator's point of view. So I think he would be able to put together a terrific terrific show.
Yeah, we were talking about that as well, and I just can't help but think of who's the studio that does Attack on Titan. Does anybody know the show that I'm addicted to on Netflix now? I know I'm late to the party on Attack on Titan, but I see the giants on there, and just the way they handle scale and mass.
Only one. Brian Smith was just talking about that.
I'm telling you, that show is as Smitty would say, bananas in a good way. So. That's fantastic.
That's cool. I am, by the way, in Shanghai now. I'm coming to you from Shanghai, and that's also another possibility. There are companies here in China that I think would be terrific to work on this. They're up-and-coming companies, and I'd love to hook you up with some of them.
Ni hao.
Ni hao back.
And that's my, one of my final questions before I guess Mark Morrell gets to some of the fan ones. You really, you look at your body of work and you became, known as the guy who can help translate these themes and inject your own original sort of through lines and stuff into that material. I mean, and now you're on the edge of the Chinese animation emergence. Did you ever think that this journey would take you here, and where do you see the future going? As I really see you on the edge of that sort of the future of animation. And
thanks. It's really fun to think about that and talk about it. I certainly never anticipated this. I went to Japan, as I mentioned originally, for world events. As their rep, and I was just like, oh, yes, I want to go. I was very excited about it. I met with Tsunayuki Morishima, who turned out, became a mentor of mine. I later worked with him on the Astro Boy series and other stuff, and he was absolutely terrific and someone who I owe a lot of thanks to. And through him, really started getting immersed in the culture, certainly something that I never expected. But once you're here, you can feel it. I mean, Asia is just expanding. It's full of opportunities. It's new. there's so much happening here. There's so many opportunities here that I love being here, and I keep trying to, you know, trying to get back here. And I lived here last year in China, but I've also been working with Korean companies. They're also coming on. And of course, always for, my first love is working with the Japanese companies. I really feel like they're the future. The future is really coming out of Asia. It's, and so it's really fun for me to be working here. And I'm looking forward to a lot more. You know, I mean, on a practical level, China has capital that America doesn't have. China's wide open. They're developing. Maybe I can talk about this a little bit if this is of interest.
Yeah.
Here's the thing about Japan. As of the end of World War II, Japan sort of came out of the ashes, reimagined itself, and especially with people who I mentioned like Tezuka, they developed their own style of anime out of manga and into anime, and they have had all of these years to develop that since the 1950s, so it's over half a century. So they have their own style, their own way of thinking of things, whereas the Chinese didn't do that because of the whole communist thing in China. They weren't in, and the nature of, you know, they went into a period of civil war after World War II. So it was very different for them. And they did not have that experience of creating manga and creating anime. So they're just catching up now. China is just catching up now. So where the Japanese have a very clear style that they developed, the Chinese don't. They like Japanese style. They like American style. They like other styles. And they're not quite sure yet what their style is. They're still developing it. But the nature of China is they develop very fast. Once they're on track, it's like breathtaking how fast they build and how fast they develop. So we're at a moment in time right now where that's what's happening in China. There's a lot of really creative people here, really bright people here, and we're in the middle of that change. So I think you're going to see a lot of stuff coming out of China soon. It's an exciting place to be.
Are there a lot of universities built up with a lot of different like majors and everything built around animation?
Just starting. It's just starting. The majors are just getting into the game. It's like they're here, but they're not quite sure what they want to do. They're just developing their game plans, and they're just figuring out how to work with the Chinese government. The Chinese government is just figuring out how to work with them. It's all at a very early stage. So I think a lot is going to happen here soon.
Okay.
Well, I would just piggyback on what Mark was saying there and just wonder, a lot of our fans listening are interested in getting involved in creative endeavors, and just as you see this new horizon approaching, Mark, what would be your advice to someone wanting to get into what you do?
Well, okay, I hadn't really thought of it, but I you know, the first thing that flashes through my mind is, it's kind of crazy, it's learn Chinese, learn Mandarin, learn to speak Mandarin, learn to speak Japanese, one or the other or both. But here's why I say Chinese. Much as I love Japan and Japanese culture and you know, Voltron is a Japanese show, the thing is they have great writers in Japan. So if I go to Japan, they don't really need me. They have great directors in Japan. They have great animators in Japan. So, and they have their own way of doing things. So for a Westerner to try to work with them is very difficult, no matter how skilled you are. Whereas in China, it's just the opposite. They're just at that stage where they're developing. So they need writers. They need people who are involved. And they need people who are bicultural, who understand both cultures and both languages. So I think it's anybody who is really bilingual in Mandarin right now, it's rare and valuable.
Now, do you see a trend in either China or Japan where they're trying to reboot old properties like we kind of do here?
Well, it's a good question. You know, that's what Imaji was doing. You know, they did the Astro Boy movie and all of that. And I met with them at some point. I want to be diplomatic about how I say this, but my impression was that, you know, Imaji is a Hong Kong-based company. They did the Turtles movie, and they had a lot of success, and they had a lot of capital, and then they started working on exactly what you're saying. Picking up old successful shows and doing new versions of them. They did the Astro Boy movie, and they were working on a Gatchaman movie, and they tanked. They weren't successful. There were some very talented people there working on those things. It's not like they weren't good. The directors and the animators and the writers, you know, they had some really good people there. But my own opinion, and, you know, I say this gingerly, I think when they did Astro Boy, I think they failed to sufficiently tune into Japanese culture. They failed to really connect with Japanese culture and go, what is this all about? Why is this a beloved character? What is the whole Astro Boy thing about? Why is this remembered, you know, 50 years later? Actually, it's hard for me to express how dear Astro Boy is and how dear Tezuka is to the Japanese people. Every animator knows them. Every animator has this, you know, great respect and honor for them. Why are they still so beloved so many years later? You have to tune into that. And I feel, I know the sound, I don't mean to sound harsh because, again, I respect these guys and what they did. But I think they came at it with an American kind of view of like, hey, we know how to make a successful movie that's going to be internationally successful. We know the elements and we know how to you know, make this happen. And they failed to catch what was specifically Japanese and special about it. And I think that, you know, that fell down. And honestly, I think the whole orientation, it's fine to pick up old shows, but you have to breathe new life into them. You have to be open to new ideas and new creative ideas. I think the idea that, hey, this was an old show that was successful before, so let's just do it again. If you don't really breathe new life into it, you have something that's like a museum piece. And I think that's the danger in that.
Well, that's a great explanation. I was just thinking about what you had said when you were describing what a storyline for a new Voltron movie might have. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about the fact that there's a part of the American public who's tired of seeing rebooted things over and over again, like Amazing Spider-Man.
Yes.
You know, we've seen the Spider-Man origin story so many times and the Superman origin story and all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
We want to see new stories with these characters.
Right. That's why, with all respect to Jeremy, I know you like the idea of doing the origin story of Voltron, and I would like to see that too, but that's why I didn't go to an origin story, exactly what you're saying. We've seen that, you know, rediscovering it, you know. And the appeal of an origin story is you see the characters for the first time going, oh my God, that's Voltron, you know. That's cool. You know, you see them discovering their new powers. But the downside of an origin story is that you have a lot of exposition. You're explaining all of this stuff of how everything works, and you have all of these scenes of them discovering things rather than just getting into the heart of the story. I like the idea of jumping into the middle of a story and just, you know, making it exciting out of the box. And then you can tell some of the origin in flashbacks or whatever if you need to.
No, you're right, Mark, and those are great points, and it is always a balance every time we would talk about the Voltron movie, because on the flip side, a producer will say, well, you know what? The movie-going audience today hasn't seen Voltron. They don't know what this is, and that was a lot of struggle with Voltron for us, and maybe we tried to split the difference a little bit and just have this new, you know, voice come in, but we were still tied to the past. I don't know the answer. Sure. I think we all know it when we see it, so that's why I think something like what you were describing, it's like, man, go directly after the fans, assume that they've seen all this. So I don't know. It's tough, but we'll see.
You're right. That's a judgment call. The show that I'm working on right now in China, we're reviving an old show. And we have all those same kinds of questions. Well, what do the fans know? What don't they know? What do we need to start off with? But my sense with a show like Voltron is, it doesn't matter if you've ever seen it before or you already know what happens when you see that, you know, when you see those robot lions roaring through the sky over the, you know, over the New York skyline, that's exciting, you know. And then as the story goes forward, you can get, you know, you can fill in the information. Well, who are they? Where do they come from? What's going on? But you don't need to set it all up. Just throw us into the middle of the story and, you know, and let's go for a ride.
Well, and I think just the way people consume media is changing so much, too, that, you know, you can argue that, you know what, people who aren't caught up to speed, they're going to see it on Netflix, and kids, you know, they're smart. I mean, they're going to research Star Wars, you know, you show any of them episode 4, they want to go deep, they want to go in the mythology. So I could see where just the streaming video revolution could change that sort of thinking, and everybody wants that big expanded universe with all kinds of details. So maybe we're going to see the pendulum swing away from kind of origins and more, you know, just let's get in deep.
Yeah, that's a good point. They'll be looking it up on their iPhone while they're watching it. I'll get all the info there.
Voltron will be back after these messages.
That concludes part 1 of our interview with Mark Handler. Join us next week for part two, where Mark answers fans' questions and lets us in on his current projects. Join us next week on Let's Voltron.